This is Cheryl Paul, and I am deeply honored and delighted to be speaking today with John Robbins. John is the author of the international bestseller Diet for a New America, How Your Food Choices Affect Your Health, Happiness, and the Future of Life on Earth, The Food Revolution, How Your Diet Can Help Save Your Life and Our World, Healthy at 100, The Scientifically Proven Secrets of the World's Healthiest and Longest-Lived Peoples, The Awakened Heart, Meditations on Finding Harmony in a Changing World, and Reclaiming Our Health, Exploding the Medical Myth, and Embracing the Source of True Healing, and his latest, The New Good Life, Living Better Than Ever in an Age of Less. The only son of the founder of the Baskin-Robbins ice cream empire, John Robbins was groomed to follow in his father's footsteps, but chose to walk away from Baskin-Robbins and the immense wealth it represented to, quote, pursue the deeper American dream, the dream of a society at peace with its conscience because it respects and lives in harmony with all life forms, a dream of a society that is truly healthy, practicing a wise and compassionate stewardship of a balanced ecosystem. John's work has been the subject of cover stories and feature articles in the San Francisco Chronicle, the Los Angeles Times, Chicago Life, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and many of the nation's other major newspapers and magazines. He is the recipient of the Rachel Carson Award, the Albert Schweitzer Humanitarian Award, the Peace Abbey's Courage of Conscience Award, and Lifetime Achievement Awards from groups including Green America. You can read more about him and his work at johnrobbins.info. So welcome, John. I'm really, truly honored that you're taking this time to speak with me and share your insights and wisdom with my audience. I have pages of notes here that I had prepared for this interview, and I'm sure we'll get to them later. But in light of the recent tragic events in Japan, I feel compelled to start there. So my work, my passion, and the lens through which I see and understand the world is transitions. And it's clear that our Earth is in transition. It's clear that the unsustainable and power-based paradigms that drive our world are crumbling, that Mother Earth has had enough of our conspicuous consumption, and that we're being called to create a new, sustainable way of life. But just as we cannot have the rebirth of spring without the death of autumn and the stillness of winter, so the birth of a new consciousness and paradigm shift cannot fully take root until the old ways, belief systems, and paradigms are pulled out by the roots. This is my model of hope, that the old ways are crumbling and dying to create space for new ways to emerge. This doesn't make it less painful or heartbreaking to witness the devastation, extinction, suffering, and death, but this context is a lifeline for me, at least, to prevent me from falling into hopelessness, panic, or despair. So I have two questions for you. The first is, what's the and you can answer these in any order you feel compelled. What's the contextual framework through which you understand what's happening in our world? And the second question is, how do you personally manage the grief, fear, and or despair about the current state of the world?
Well, thank you for having me, Cheryl, and you've just said so much that is so profound. And I thank you for that. It places our conversation or initiates our conversation at a very real level. Not everybody today is wanting to actually address the significance of the grief that we feel, of the pain that we feel, of the possibilities that are real in the midst of the breakdowns that are happening, because our society has so much denial in it.
Yes,
we're kind of masters of it. We amuse ourselves to death almost. As in a culture where mass distraction is so pervasive, it is harder to be present with grief, to be present with fear, to be present with pain and suffering in a way that is transformative, in a way that is actually empowering, so that we can translate the vulnerability that we feel into the strength and commitment to respond. I know that for myself, and I suspect for a lot of people, what's happening in Japan right now evokes a lot of feelings of fragility. vulnerability. Obvious. I live in California, so we're on the other side of the Pacific Rim here, and I actually live in Santa Cruz, which is where a major earthquake was centered in 1989. Mm. But all of the West Coast, of course, is earthquake territory, and in fact, the whole world is fragile and vulnerable to Mother Nature in ways that we don't want to look at. We want to think we're in control, and that we want to think. Most of us want to think that we can just continue to economic growth, and we'll just be on. You know, we'll just keep happening, and we'll find our. We'll work our way out of all of our messes with technology, and we're so smart that we can do that. We are the smartest species, we like to think, that ever lived on this earth. We're the pinnacle of creation, and we deserve, you know, to dominate the planet and use its resources and exploit its creatures and have our way with this world. And we there's a hubris in that that's egregious. And there's a separation in that, an isolation in that that's very, very painful. We have created a way of life. We have defined success and prosperity and the goal of life. We have a mindset that is not only environmentally sustainable, unsustainable, that is not only devouring resources at a totally rapacious rate and producing toxins and pollution at escalating rates that are completely that the planet can't absorb. But it's also spiritually devastating to us. It separates us from each other. It separates us from the powers of nature. It separates us from the work to live in harmony with each other, with respect for ourselves and one another, to live in harmony with the whole web of life.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the work that is in front of us anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so these kinds of events, like what are taking place now in Japan, and I see this tremendous grief for what is happening there.
Mm-hmm.
But the work is still in front of us, and maybe the grief even presents it more starkly.
Mm-hmm.
That we need to find a way to live on this earth with each other, with the planet's resources and limitations, with the beauty that's here, the creativity that's here, and the limits that are here. You know, with a discipline, with a clarity that's grounded in both in the possibilities and the limitations that now are present.
So do you think that when events happen on such a massive and undeniable scale as what's happened in Japan, that it, if there's any good that can come, and it's hard to even say that when there's so much heartbreak, but if there's any good that can come, that it can break through some of the denial?
Well, it can. You know, people ask me, and one of your questions, I think, touched on this. People ask each other all the time, but do you have hope? Do you have reasons for hope today?
Mm-hmm.
What hope can you have, realistically? And I answer that in an unusual way. I think hope is necessary, but I don't think it's sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bridge to something, but we have to cross that bridge to actions. And let me put it this way. There's a kind of a metaphor between what is resignation and what is hope and what is change.
Mm-hmm.
Say you know, somebody's overweight and not in good shape, and kind of, which is typical in our society. And you're walking down the street and you pass a donut shop and you think, oh, what's another donut? You know, it doesn't matter. I've eaten so many. You know, and you go in, you eat a donut or 10, and you pass, you're walking down the street, you see a gym, and you think, oh, I wouldn't do it even if I signed up. You know, it's not for me. I'd look terrible in a gym's shorts or whatever. And so that's resignation. and I've had a lot of them. I could do without a donut. I could probably not eat a donut just right now. And then you pass the gym and you think, well, I could sign up. I could do that. I could, you know, get a nice some clothes to work out in, and you know that maybe I'd get down a size in, you know, in a few weeks, and you know that's hope.
Mm-hmm.
But change as you're walking down the street, you see the donut and say, no way, and you find some healthy food and you eat it, and then you see the gym, and it's not about signing up. You go and work out.
Mm-hmm.
You show up. Mm-hmm. And you take on the practice,
mm-hmm,
of energizing your body and feeding yourself healthy food and eating consciously and exercising regularly and changing your way of life into one that's more expressive for you of your,
mm-hmm,
your the animation of your spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think of hope as a necessary step on the way from resignation and passivity and collapse to real action and change, but it's not the whole thing. And what I think enables us to move from the mindset of scarcity and deprivation and pain and fear to one of sufficiency, where our creativity can most best emerge,
mm-hmm,
is gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
That there's always, under the worst of circumstances, there are still things to be grateful for.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can remember that, then we will be best able to respond to adversity. We will be best able to be resilient in the face of disasters and catastrophes when they occur. And we will be best able to create the best possible outcomes,
mm-hmm,
under the circumstances that occur in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have the power of gratitude available to us. It is a choice we can make. We can remember.
Yes.
And I'm not saying something as flippant as count your blessings,
right,
although I suppose that's one place to start. But I'm actually talking about something much deeper than that, which is how much we do genuinely have reason to be grateful for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And each of us, I think, I mean, for me, it's a spiritual practice, honestly, to recall and to bring to mind and to appreciate the spirit of goodness in people in my life and the opportunities to respond from the depths of my humanity to the pain and suffering in the world and in myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what enables me, I think, to get through transitions in a way that's healing, that's growthful, in which there's learning and change and the opportunity to make a real difference,
mm-hmm,
in my life and in the lives of the people I love and touch.
Mm-hmm. That's all very powerful and very beautifully said, and actually segues into my next question for you, which is that, while your books aren't directly about transitions, as I've read through them, I've noticed that they're all indirectly connected to transitions in the sense that if someone were to embrace the paradigm shift that you propose in each one, he or she would be willing to let go of what's familiar and make room for a new lifestyle or belief system. So in Diet for a New America, you propose transitioning from a meat-eating diet to a vegetarian diet, which requires letting go of familiar dietary habits and learning about an entirely new lifestyle. In Healthy at 100, you focus on our culture's belief systems regarding the transition of aging, which I'd like to discuss more in depth in a few minutes, and encourage a paradigm shift from the dread of aging to looking forward to aging. And in The New Good Life, the focus is on our economy, our relationship to money, and the transition of letting go of the old good life of conspicuous consumption and embracing a new good life of conscious consumption. So in order to adopt these various paradigm shifts that you discuss, a letting go is required, and there must be a willingness to change, yet it's usually someone's resistance to change, to the grief and the fear that must be acknowledged when you're letting go of a familiar and old way of life that prevents them from letting go of the habitual lifestyle. So as someone who is called and committed to raising consciousness on many levels, why do you think most people are so resistant to change?
Oh, we're afraid. We're afraid. Mm-hmm. We cling to what's familiar even when it's painful.
And do you think that's just a natural human condition? That's the habitual response?
Well, I think it's part of the human psyche, but I think our culture has, in particular, developed a mindset, a sense of self, that is uniquely frightened about change because we're so separated from each other.
Mm.
There's so much about our society that's competitive, that's
mm-hmm.
every man for himself, every man or woman. It pits people against each other. You know, I think we have, as human beings, we have a capacity to compete and we have a capacity to cooperate.
Mm-hmm.
And when those two capacities are in balance, there's a strength to us, a wholeness. But I think our society has gone out of balance profoundly
mm-hmm.
in accentuating the competitive aspect of us and neglecting the our need to cooperate
mm-hmm.
and the reciprocity, the power of that when we are in connection with each other.
Right.
And so feeling as alone, as isolated, as many of us do, that's one of the reasons we're so afraid and so resistant to change. And there's a sense of fear in ourselves. We don't know that we're going to be taken care of. We don't know that we're going to be part of each other's lives. We don't know that our love really matters
mm-hmm.
Too often. People die of loneliness in our society.
Mm-hmm.
They die of the lack of connection with one another, and particularly as people age, that's true. But it's true in childhood. It's true at every stage. We're social beings, and
mm-hmm.
we thrive most fully when we are in genuine connection with each other.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an awful lot of things in our society that impair that. So
right, and that's interesting because that you answered the question in that way and focusing on the alienation, the isolation. In my two primary areas of focus in transitions have been the wedding, getting married, and becoming a parent, and certainly the sense of isolation around the difficult feelings that emerge is so acute for most people that that's what sends them into depression or anxiety. And that once they learn that they are not alone and connect to a community of people that are experiencing exactly what they're experiencing, they're able to then make that leap into the new life, into the unknown, much easier. Knowing that they will have that safety net and I draw upon indigenous cultures work a lot because, of the field of transitions and Arnold Van Gennep, who brought the term rite of passage to our culture and studied indigenous cultures around the world, and certainly the sense of connectiveness is inbred into those cultures. And I doubt that they fear change and transition and the unknown as much as we do because they are so held within the web of their culture.
Yes, yes. We've created a society in which people don't have that sense of security. I mean, just the basic fact that we are the only industrialized country in the world that doesn't provide basic health care to all of its citizens reflects what I'm saying, that and at the level of medical care and health, an awful lot of people are very frightened. We have bankruptcies. More bankruptcies occur as a result of medical costs than any other reason.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sense that we're not taking care of each other.
Mm-hmm.
We're not taking care of those who are less fortunate. We're not taking care of our elders. We're not taking care of our children. We're sort of developed a society that, we make excess into a status symbol.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think it's kind of a shameful thing.
Right.
I think if someone hoards resources and accumulates resources for their own grandiosity, rather than in order to use them to contribute
mm-hmm.
to the well-being of others and creating more beauty in the world and more health in the world and more joy in the world and more compassion in the world. And, when someone just it's attributed to their own ego and narcissism, they're when we say, well, if you say in our society somebody's a success, isn't it that what's generally meant by that is that they've made a lot of money, that they their net worth is high?
Mm-hmm. So you walked away from that life at quite a young age. How old were you, 21 or 18?
21.
Yes. 21. So you made that choice, and I imagine, I was thinking about you in preparation for this transition, for this interview about transitions, what that transition must have been like for you. What you went through to walk away from a life that was so out of alignment with your core values, and forge into something completely unknown. You know,
well, it was wild. It was an adventure. It was. Mm-hmm. I was very curious about where it would go. I made a choice for integrity, really.
And did you grieve? I imagine there was a loss of that kind of connectedness to your family. Was there grief involved?
Well, yes. And see, in my case, just so our listeners know, my dad and my uncle founded and owned Baskin-Robbins, 31 Flavors, the ice cream company, and I was my father's only son, and he groomed me to succeed him. The expectation was that I would one day take over the company, work with him, and follow in his footsteps. And I actually grew up liking that. I loved ice cream. What kid doesn't, you know?
Right.
But as my own values began to emerge and I started to feel pulled in a very different direction, I remember saying to my dad one day, well, we live in a different world than when you grew up. Today we live under a nuclear shadow where at any moment the unspeakable could happen. The environment is deteriorating rapidly under the impact of human activities. The gap between the wealthy and the poor is increasing. Resources are concentrating in the hands of ever fewer people, which is not only unjust and unfair, but it's cruel and it's destabilizing to any social coherence, and it doesn't portend a healthy world. It's a frightening prospect. And I said, under these circumstances, with so much going awry, do you see that for me, anyway, feeling as strongly as I do about these things, inventing a 30-second flavor just would not be an adequate response for my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I did choose to walk away from Baskin-Robbins and the family fortune, and I told my dad I didn't want to have a trust fund. I didn't want to depend on his financial achievements. I didn't want to have any dependence whatsoever on his fortune. Because I wanted to live by my own values and seek my own way in life and not be, I didn't want to inherit the fears and the belief system that my dad, that basically my father lived by. So I felt to be consistent and honest with that choice, I needed to also not inherit the money.
Mm-hmm. And that was such a courageous choice you made that I'm sure very few people would have made or have made. I'm just so curious I'm sure you were, you know, emblazoned and emboldened by that choice and felt inspired by it. But, you know, in my work of transitions, I imagine there was also some crumbling, some letting go.
It was very difficult in the family because my father had, he'd worked very hard. He'd mm-hmm. achieved a level of financial success most people could only dream about. He wanted to share that with his only son.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets, I'm sure it must have seemed to him, the only kid in the country that would have turned that down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's cruel to him. I felt bad about it. I didn't want to hurt him. Mm-hmm. I certainly didn't want to be disrespectful. But I tried to be as tactful and diplomatic about it as I could be, but the fact was I was, in effect, rejecting his life work.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very painful to him. He was very angry about it. It created a very complicated relationship for he and I.
Mm-hmm.
Although, in the long run of things, ended up being... There was a tremendous amount of reconciliation in our lives together.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up being very proud of the work I ended up doing and the choice and the values I was living, have lived by and have advocated. And even though he didn't see eye to eye with many of my ideas, he had a sense of that I had chosen integrity, and he had a lot of respect and pride for me in the end. And interestingly enough, he developed, my uncle, Bert Baskin, my dad's partner, brother-in-law, died of a heart attack in his early 50s. My dad developed very serious diabetes, high blood pressure, heart problems, the typical kind of consequences that go with that kind of lifestyle and eating a lot of ice cream. And I, he ended up changing his diet because of his health problems, very much into alignment with what I've been talking about, getting tremendous results for himself physically, living many more years than was expected at one point, and really getting that the kind of things I've been talking about and advocating for make sense. And so in the long run, he felt grateful that I had, as he put it, followed my own star.
That's amazing. That's very inspiring. So what have been the most challenging transitions in your life, times when you felt like you were falling apart, but from that crumbling, something new was birthed?
Well, I think one of the most difficult occurred for me, I'll have to give it a little story, background to it so people can understand, but I did walk away from I grew up in a family with immense wealth and walked away from it entirely and lived very simply for many years with my wife and our son, and she and I have been together now 44 years. And eventually my books became bestsellers and money began to flow through our lives, and we still lived very simply and saved. And our son, 10 years ago, he and his wife, our daughter in love, as we call her, gave birth to extremely premature twins who suffered significant oxygen deprivation to their brains at birth and afterwards. And they are now 10 years old. They are autistic, brain-injured, and seriously retarded kids with a lot of special needs. And I knew at when this happened, when they were born and these things occurred, that this was, there were going to be a lot of costs to this. That the parenting journey that we, our son and his wife, who live with us, we all live together, we're called to. It was exhausting and challenging and difficult and costly. So I thought, well, we have some savings. That's good. And a friend of mine, an attorney, wealthy man who was on the board of several of the nonprofits I'd founded, knew what occurred and said he had an excellent investment that he was involved with and that was provided very steady, decent returns. And he was a very, very wealthy man. And he said his money, his family's money was in it, and he invited me to participate. And he said he knew that this would help with the cost of raising the twins. And I did that, and he suggested that we mortgage our property to the maximum in order to invest that money in along with his, and we did. And then in December 11th, actually, of 2008, he called me and said, "I have terrible, terrible news." And my first thought was there'd been a car accident, or he had some problem in his marriage, or you know, his health, or something. But no, he said it's about the money. I said, "What?" He said, "It's all gone." It turns out that he had invested all of our money, along with his, in a fund that was in turn invested with Bernard Madoff. Now, I had never heard of Bernard Madoff. I had never heard the name before, but overnight, 95% of our net worth was gone. And so that was pretty devastating, and I was frightened, and I was, because I have the responsibilities of these special needs twins, It how were we going to handle this? It was very, very frightening.
Mm.
And we all banded together and worked very hard and did a lot of things and are still doing things to recover from that. I found that, I mean, at first it was just horrible, honestly. I hated it. It was like it had all the joy of a car accident, you know, a terminal diagnosis or something, just a dreadful experience.
Mm.
But our family, you know, situations like this either tear a family apart or bring it together in a new way
mm-hmm.
of commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened with us.
Mm.
Everybody did what they could. We sold everything we owned that could be sold. We rented out every room in our house that we could. I sleep in my office. You know, we did everything we could to find a way through this. And we got help. Friends came to our aid with some loans and some gifts and some help in different kinds of ways. Different people could offer different things and moral support, emotional support. And you know, we're working our way back towards sufficiency now.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel that what happened to us was a very abrupt version of what is happening to a lot of people today. It happened to us overnight. Most times it's not quite so dramatic as that. But the things that people have relied on for their security, for their sense of financial well-being, for their retirement, for their future, for their sense of prosperity in the world, in many cases are being pulled out from under them.
Mm-hmm.
People are their house is underwater, or their retirement is gone, their pension is gone, or the job is gone, or there's a lot of things in the economy today that are working against people's hopes and dreams for a better life. And so we have to reassess what really gives us quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I come back to gratitude, because if I hadn't been able to say, even in the midst of the hell of literally overnight losing 95% of our net worth, and accompanied by having the responsibilities of having little boys who are profoundly have very profound special needs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I could have retained any sanity, frankly, in the midst of it.
That it was the gratitude that got
it was the gratitude, like that even in that there are things to be grateful for, and we can build on those.
Mm-hmm.
We have strengths, we have intelligences, we have. And why I say intelligence is plural, because, again, our society defines intelligence in a narrow way.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the analytical capacity of our minds. But I think rhythm is an intelligence. Music is an intelligence. Imagination is an intelligence. The ability to cooperate and nurture relationships is an emotional intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many kinds of intelligence. And art is an intelligence, and different people have different strengths and intelligences that are most strong in their makeup. And if you can draw on the intelligences within you, the many, many kinds of them, and on the many kinds of intelligence that other people have, suddenly there's a brilliance operating.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I'm very grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. So, on this topic of multiple intelligences, and what I see happening in our culture, and I think our world, I see a rising consciousness. Despite the breakdown and the devastation and the loss, I do see a rising consciousness among so many people and groups of people. And I don't think it's just because I live here in Boulder. You know, I think that there really is something new trying to emerge, trying to be born. And one of the areas that I see it that is very close to my heart, and even though you haven't written about this directly in any of your books, I have a feeling you've thought about it, is in the area of education. and it's close to my heart. My older son is a highly out-of-the-box type of kid, and I could see very early on that he would have been crushed in any type of typical full-time school environment. Before I had him, I never thought I would have homeschooled, but here we are 6.5 years in and homeschooling.
How old is he?
He's 6.5.
Uh-huh.
This has very clearly been the right path for him. Although it's quite a countercultural path and certainly not one I ever expected to find myself on. I loved school as a kid and, you know, I just thought we'd send him off to school and he was 3 and that would be that. And surprisingly, many of my closest friends have also chosen to homeschool and we've engaged in countless hours of passionate conversation about this topic. So, you know, as part of this rising consciousness, I think that...
You know, our son was homeschooled.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Wow. See, so, right. I think that there is a paradigm shift happening in the way that we approach education and learning, and one that is more organic, more connected, one where we don't just separate kids from parents all day long. I see part-time schools and homeschool learning collectives emerging all over the country. So I would just love to hear your thoughts on this topic, both as a parent, in that you made that choice to homeschool, and also as someone who's committed to raising consciousness in general.
Well, I think homeschooling is wonderful if the parents have the time and resources to create an environment that works for the child.
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone does.
Right.
There's a lot of people who are working 2 jobs and can't,
mm-hmm.
even if they might like to and want to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's difficult. The way we raise our children, the way we educate our children, says a great deal about the kind of people we're becoming.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always thought of education, the root of the word education, it comes from the Latin educare, which means to draw out, to bring out the knowledge, the wisdom that is in a person, in a child, as distinct from imposing information on them.
Right.
And imposing belief systems on them. And true education is lighting a fire. It's not it's just simply bombarding a person with information and data. We sometimes confuse memorization with learning.
Yeah.
And curiosity, the ability to be curious and to be in wonder, those are intelligences to me. Curiosity is a powerful form of intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And we in our educational system, we sometimes subjugate kids to systems of, quote, learning that don't honor their curiosity, don't respond to and nurture their desire to learn in their own unique ways. And that's too bad.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of people, and you are obviously one of them, and you're tracking others, as I do too, who want to raise kids who are more self-reliant than that and more connected to their own intelligences and wisdom and strengths and
mm-hmm.
curiosities and inquiries and questions. And out of that, the life that comes out of that is so much more whole and healing and responsive.
Mm.
I think that the homeschooling movement in this country is going to grow a lot
mm-hmm.
in the years to come, partly because mass education, the public school system, is breaking down.
Mm-hmm.
We aren't funding it very well, and we're imposing priorities on it. You know, teachers have to teach to the test.
Mm-hmm.
It's just taking us away from responding to each child as an individual.
Right, and it's in those kinds of breakdowns, like the breakdown of our economy, like you talk about in The New Good Life, that then creates the possibility for building something, a different value system, a new good life, and then the breakdown of our education system, whether it's by force, because people are forced to pull their kids out because it's just not working, or from a deeper intention that's originating from inside of them, there are these new systems, these new paradigms that are emerging. You know, and I agree. I think that the homeschool movement, I mean, it has grown so much already in the last 20 or 30 years. I'm sure when you were homeschooling your son, there weren't very many people doing that.
No, there weren't. It was, and now there is much more widespread.
Mm-hmm. And so what contributed to you and your wife deciding to homeschool Ocean?
Well, he's such a unique person, and mm-hmm. He wasn't thriving in even the alternative public schools that we were able mm-hmm. to put him in. We couldn't afford private schools. And so that seemed like the best option
mm-hmm.
to help him grow. And you know, people sometimes say, well, yeah, but they need the social experiences. Well, they need social experiences, but they don't need social experiences of being in cages and being in social environments that are highly stressful in which nobody's needs are being met.
Right, right.
That's not healthy social experiences.
And, no, and sadly, so often the social experiences in school are not loving and nurturing and supportive ones. I mean, there's
And you know, wouldn't it be great if in our schools we helped kids to deal with their feelings, their fears, and their issues with each other, their conflicts in a constructive and healthy way.
Yeah,
you know, to be creative in their ways of dealing with conflict. Conflict is going to occur, but it's not in itself dangerous or damaging. It's how we deal with conflict.
Right.
That's important. And differences, of course, there is going to be differences. But we can honor those, we can celebrate those, we can find fertility and growth there.
Absolutely. So we only have a few minutes left. I just would like to go into a little bit more depth with my final question. It's something you talk about in Healthy at 100 on the topic of aging and death. It seems to me that the fear of aging that you talk about so beautifully in Healthy at 100, just love that book, is two-pronged. One, it's the cultural fear we have of the transition into elderhood and being older, and two, it's the fear of death. And while the fear of death is part of being human, I think, it seems that our culture has a particularly acute fear of death, and it's this fear that contributes to our resistance to change and our inability to move through transitions more gracefully. One of my favorite quotes that speaks to this is from Pema Chodron, who says, "Some of the Buddhist teachings have this cheerful teaching on from the moment you're born, you're starting to die. Another way of saying it is everything that manifests, everything that's composite, is also falling apart. I think where this gets really interesting is that as a dynamic in our everyday, moment-by-moment, ordinary experience of life, for some reason we are programmed and patterned to resist this fluidness, this groundlessness. And all the practice is about learning to relax into groundlessness, learning to soften and open to the groundlessness. In other words, practice is about embracing the wholeness of experience, not just trying to avoid that which is groundless and grab onto that which is solid. As long as we resist the groundless part, we suffer a lot." So what are your thoughts on this, and what are your practices for learning to let go into the groundlessness of everyday life?
Well, Pema Chodron, of course, is a Buddhist teacher, and I have a lot of appreciation for that aspect of Buddhism that helps us to be more spacious and surrendered to the forces of life that are.
Mm-hmm.
I actually love the Serenity Prayer. It's used in AA and mm-hmm. other addiction recovery groups a lot. It's simple. It asks that we be given the courage to change the things that we can, that we be given the serenity to accept the things that we cannot change, and that we be given the wisdom to know the difference.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the Buddhist aspect of surrendering to the groundlessness is half of it. At the same time, I want to be active in the ways that I can, be courageous in the ways that I can, be dedicated in the ways that I can be to change the things I can.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot that needs to be changed in our world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be obsessive about it. I don't want to lose track of the beauty. But I do crave to see a human presence on this planet that is spiritually fulfilling and environmentally sustainable and socially just. And I think it's within our capacity still.
Yeah.
It's easy to give up hope. It's easy to feel hopeless and helpless in the midst of what is occurring today. But the effort to see the transitions in a way where we live with gratitude enough that we can see the opportunities that are here,
mm-hmm.
even
mm-hmm.
even as things fall apart, even as
right.
the groundlessness emerges. That's where I'm excited.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I feel most alive.
So it's in that balance of knowing when to surrender to the groundlessness and knowing when to take action.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then to be fearless. You know, in action, fearless, and in peace, fearless.
Mm-hmm.
Every time we move from fear to compassion, every time we move from vulnerability to strength,
mm.
We take a step on behalf of all of life.
Mm-hmm.
And we're so connected. We don't know how connected we are. We think we're separate. We think we're individuals. We think we're autonomous. And at one level we are, but at a very deep level we are not. We're part of each other's dreams. We're part of each other's prayers. We're part of each other's hopes. We're part of each other's breath.
Mm-hmm.
And we're part of each other's hearts. And but that, in that mutual interdependence, in that interbeing, our greatest strength lies,
mm.
I think. Certainly, that's where I send my roots.
Mm. And that is a beautiful place to end. I want to thank you, John. I know you are extremely busy. I really want to thank you for taking the time out of your life and your day to have this conversation.
Well, thank you, Cheryl, and I wanted to do so. I love your work from what I've seen of it, and I certainly have appreciated the thoughtfulness with which you brought to this conversation, and that you bring to all your conversations, really, and what you offer to people, and I thank you for that.
Thank you. Okay, have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye bye.
Bye bye.